Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. And we've got another old friend of the program back. I had one yesterday and have another one today. James Petras is back. And the program is always first rate when Jim comes on. So much to talk about. Jim is a professor emeritus in sociology at Binghamton University in New York. And oh, his career is so long and distinguished. He's written so many books, so many hundreds of articles. He seems to put out a new book at least once a year. I just don't know how he does it. But they keep coming, and I keep reading them. So much to talk about, Jim. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Steve. It's a pleasure to be with you and enjoy the conversation.
Oh, you know I enjoy it. I love having you back. We do need to get a lot of voices on, but I'd be happy to have a conversation with you all the time. Well, we could, because we could get into most every single topic we discuss in the program. You write about them at one point or other. And, there's so much we can go into today. Why don't we start with what happened to Venezuela on Sunday? They had a little election, a referendum, something that would be impossible to happen in this country. We have state referendums here, but of course nothing on a national level. And they let the voting public decide on what should or should not be in the country's constitution. Imagine that happening here, Jim.
Yes, it's quite an experience, democratic experience, and I think it points to the importance of learning from other progressive countries where the weight of public opinion should be in the political system.
Oh, indeed. Well, they had a referendum way back at the beginning of this decade. They had, I forget the exact date, Chavez took office February 1999, began crafting a new Bolivarian constitution. Oh, my chronology is a little off, Jim. I think it was about a year before it was put together and put to a popular vote, but it was overwhelmingly approved. And, it's a huge, huge document with all sorts of things in it to benefit the people. But they had a referendum on Sunday to remove term limits from all elected officials in the country, from local legislators to mayors to governors to the president to the members of the National Assembly. And again, they left it to the voting public to vote on this up or down. And it won a reasonably impressive victory by 9 points, about 54.5 to about 45.5.
Yes, Steve, it was a landslide in some ways, and it raises a lot of important questions. For example, the polls, especially the U.S. Subsidiaries of national polling agencies, were so wrong, so manipulated. It's hard to believe that the methodologies were at fault, when the fact is that the margins at which they predicted the outcome, and in fact the predicted defeat of Chavez in some cases, some put the margin at very small, maybe 1 or 2 points, and to be wrong by such a margin suggests that the polls were functioning less as predictors of outcomes than as propaganda vehicles trying to influence the electorate against Chavez.
Oh, indeed, Jim. We need to take a break, as you know, by that music. Let's do it, and you can pick it right up when we come back. Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Jim Petras. Jim, continue where you left off. Jim?
Yes.
Oh, please continue.
First point was that clearly the polling agencies that were operating and giving such negative results on Chavez were manipulating their data to serve political ends, especially of the opposition and U.S. Embassy. The second thing that's interesting is that the yes vote for Chavez won majorities in three states which had voted with the opposition in the recent gubernatorial and mayoralty election. And I explain that by the fact that as soon as these governors and mayors took office, they began to dismantle some of the popular programs, some of the medical centers, cultural centers, community centers that were set up by the previous Chavez governors. And in those very states where they saw what the consequences of not voting for Chavez were in terms of adversely affecting their living standards and their living conditions, they switched votes this time and voted for Chavez. So I think the lesson is very clear for people that if the opposition comes back, if Chavez is defeated, they're in for a huge fall in living conditions. And I think the change in vote, the overwhelming victory for Chavez in the constitutional amendment is indicative of that. The third thing about the elections is the high turnout favors Chavez. That is, the more people engage in political action, exercise their citizenship, the more they feel that and think that Chavez is the most appropriate leader. And I think that if we translate that in more general terms, the wider and deeper democracy, the greater the vote for Chavez and his program of participatory democracy and extending legislative powers down to the community level.
Oh, indeed, Jim. It's true that the high turnout is very, very important. The last time they had a referendum vote about a year or so ago, they made it too complicated. They had 69, if I remember the number, 69 different items in it, and it was very easy. Chavez was traveling. I think there may have been other distractions. It became easy for the opposition with a very concentrated campaign to muddy the waters and confuse people that this just wasn't what they ought to pass. And it was very close. It very narrowly went down to defeat. And what I heard, Jim, I don't know if it's true or not, was that it really won, but the margin was so tiny that Chavez decided that he wanted to fight the battle another day, that if
he
won
by... The real issue in that election was the 2 million Chavez voters who stayed at home, either overconfident or the fact that they were rebelling against some of the bad administration of federal officials and local so-called pro-Chavez mayors and governors who don't perform their duties adequately. In this case, it was a straight up and down on Chavez and demonstrated that Chavez is far more popular and recognized as much more responsive to people's needs than some of his erstwhile supporters at the local and state level.
And he did a smart thing. He included removing term limits for all elected officials, not just the president. That was a very good move. And, of course, the turnout was high, about 70%. It was a lot lower the previous time. And
we've never had a 70% turnout on any national election. So as far as if we take voting participation as an indice of democracy is certainly a much more a democratic system than ours.
Oh, indeed. Their elections are models. They have monitors come in, including the Carter Center. I don't know if the Carter Center was down this time. Maybe so. But international monitors come in, the OAS. Imagine monitors at our elections, Jim, where they have the courage, if they could even find out, to report what was going on, take a look at those computers and see how your vote can go in for candidate A, and maybe candidate B gets two votes. But Venezuela's elections are really model ones, and all the reports back are that it truly is a superb system.
If I recall correctly, during the decade of Chavez's presidency, there's been 11 elections, of which they have won 10, and that's a pretty good record. I don't
recall
the Democrats or Republicans in this country having such a outstanding record, batting average of about 900. I think here we're batting, the parties are probably batting below their weight.
He won every single time except that last referendum. It really is amazing. Months back, I wrote about it and covered them all, not just national elections, but regional, gubernatorial, mayoral elections. He won every single time.
Well, it resonates with one other president who had such an outstanding record, which was Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
Oh,
and I think the fact that Chavez has a Venezuelan-style New Deal helps explain why both Chavez and Franklin Roosevelt won so many presidential elections, despite the venomous treatment they both got in the plutocratic media.
Oh, indeed, Jim. And, of course, Chavez has delivered, to be very honest about it, has delivered much more than FDR ever did. Free education. You can get a PhD in Venezuela, no cost.
Yeah.
You can become a doctor in Venezuela, believe a doctor, a lawyer, no cost. If you get sick, free health care.
I mean, this stuff
is unimaginable in America, absolutely unimaginable. Obama won't do it.
Well, there's no comparison. Look at the how each president, U.S. versus Venezuela, facing the economic recession, the world economic. The first thing Chavez has done is bolstered funding for health, education, wage supports, subsidized food stores, and the most that the stimulus plan has nothing about subsidized food. We have food stamps, which are a palliative, and they're not giving out to all the poor, they're limited, and just extending for 12 more weeks unemployment benefits. And in Venezuela, they have a very extensive social net that has greater protection and is much better funded. Chavez has not put out hundreds of billions of dollars to bail out the bankers that caused the crisis. He's put in. He's using his reserves to maintain living standards.
And he built up a lot of reserves when oil prices were much higher. It's very hard to know. Oil prices have really come down, I think, about 75%, Jim. And given the grim world economy, it's very possible they could fall more. Back in the 1980s, it's hard for people to remember. We had a bull market in the 1980s. But oil, for some reason, really collapsed. High oil prices were nothing like today. Maybe the equivalent of $40 oil going back to the 1970s. But in the 1980s, oil prices fell to about $10 a barrel. Well, I guess it's possible it could happen again. And if it stays that way long enough, then very possibly it could have an impact.
One thing more, Steve, before we jump from this topic. In the throughout the decade, Chavez imposed controls on banks and highly regulated the flows of capital, imposed capital controls. And thanks, this, of course, was rejected by all the conventional economists, both in the United States and the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank. They said they're interfering with the free market. But including the banks in Venezuela, and yet it's the fact that there was so much regulation and control on the way in which banks turned their money around that Venezuelan financial system wasn't destroyed in the way that the free market banking policies of Greenspan wrecked the U.S. economy. So, in fact, we can say Chavez save the banks from their own self-destructive impulses and greed, and now at least there's no run on the banks from depositors fearful of what where their money is and how it was invested. They haven't had a case like the crash of Lehman Brothers, etc.
Oh, indeed, Jim, and Venezuela's economy is still growing. I think every Western economy is sinking now. Japan on Monday announced a tremendous drop, the equivalent of about 12.5% on an annual level in fourth quarter GDP. Of course, they're an export-led economy. China may have serious; they're still growing, but their rate of growth is falling. The U.S. is in deep recession and sinking. Yesterday, Jim, I had Bill Engdahl, economist Bill Engdahl, on the program, and he really does exceptional work in his writing. He believes we're in a depression. He believes it'll be worse than the 1930s, and he believes it'll last for 10 years.
Yeah, well, it's very deep. It's very profound. I think we can generally refer to it as a depression, and it's getting deeper. I'm not a prophet. I can't look ahead 10 years, but certainly this is not going to end by the end of the year.
Oh, not at all. Let's take another break, Jim, and we'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I'm on with Jim Petras. Oh, Jim, where should we jump next? More about Obama. You've done some sensational writing about him. You smelled him out early. And I must admit that I think I got onto him, too. I just followed the campaign rhetoric, and I took a look at his voting record as a senator. I honestly didn't pay any attention to him when he was a state senator in my home state of Illinois. He didn't mean much to me then. But as he gained prominence, I took a closer look, and I didn't hang in what I did. I didn't hang him. I let him hang himself.
Yes, Steve. I think there was such an enormous campaign that swept a good part of the political spectrum, especially among previously very progressive commentators and analysts who reacted more in repulsion to Republican politics and the Bush years, and took the position, well, anything must be better than Bush. And as a result, they are now backing a president who's going to be giving them exactly a Republican stimulus pattern with the huge tax write-offs for big business, huge bailouts. We don't even know the size of the bailout for the bankers. And no really productive investments in the so-called stimulus pattern. I looked through the budget with some detail, and it's really there's nothing there that's going to create long-term and stable employment. At the very best, it's going to give temporary employment to people that install communication systems, and then it's over. They build some highways, and the construction industry gets some jobs, but once the roads are built, that's it. They're out. And the big question is, when you build infrastructure, you're connecting points of production to each other. You're taking mines to steel mills. You're taking steel mills to auto factories. You're taking to machine shops, to processing plants, etc. And so you're building roads to nowhere, because our productive base in this country has shriveled so much. Disintegration of major productive activities, and both by capital flight and even worse, the fact that many previously industrial giants put their money into financial arms. And since they lost, they've run down the manufacturing sector altogether. So the question is, why hasn't Obama made a major commitment to building up our production, building publicly owned facilities like the old TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, and other places where you can create long-term, stable employment that energizes
us into a much more diversified economy. We are now a banana republic tied heavily to one particular sector, which is finance and the services. And services need a much more extensive, productive base, which we don't have today. We have a giant with a huge head and baby's legs. And I think this is what my main criticism is that we haven't moved out of the Reagan Clinton Bush framework of an economy. And I think that goes to the heart of the administration, the economic team that Obama has put together. It's straight out of Wall Street. So how are they going to think outside that box, outside of the of this highly skewed economy, which needs to move back in a different direction, move back in order to move forward. And the key question is, even within capitalist economics, there isn't a single person with any hands-on experience in the successful productive sector that's even remotely connected with the economic team that Obama has put together.
Oh, indeed, Jim. There's so much that's going on that really is so frightening. I'll just start with Obama's team, his so-called economic dream team. It's a nightmarish team. The key people are the very people who got us into the mess we're in now.
Yeah, they're all a bunch of losers.
Oh, they're a bunch of losers. I've already nominated Geithner after less than a month as Treasury Secretary as the leading candidate to be the all-time worst Treasury Secretary of any country at any time.
Well, that's going quite a ways. We had Summers that was in there. He would be highly competitive with Geithner. He was with Greenspan deregulating the economy and deregulating the regulators so that someone like Madoff could walk off with $50 billion despite warnings by a very important whistleblower and giving him for 10 years, handing him documents showing that it was impossible promote the kind of growth, investment growth that he was proclaiming, and they completely ignored him. I mean, it wasn't as if they didn't know that some shenanigans were going on. They absolutely refused, and that shows, to my mind, the unhealthy relationship between regulators and regulatees, is between financial swindlers and government officials.
Oh, indeed, Jim. We have to take another break. I don't minimize the importance of Summers for a moment.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
We're on with Jim Petras. Jim, I was saying I would never let Summers off the hook. The only thing I'll give him credit for, he's a guy with a brain, but he uses it counterproductively. It's very good for swindling the public. He's very skilled at swindling the public to enrich Wall Street and the big time as he represents. But he's the guy. He was Treasury Secretary, Clinton's Treasury Secretary. In late 1999, he gave us a Gramm-Leach-Bliley that literally turned the banks and financial institutions into massive wealth-sucking operations from us to them. Deregulation, they call it, Jim. I call it grand theft.
I think you're right, Steve, and I think it's important to point out that the beginning of this massive swindling speculator economy was facilitated under the Clinton administration. It seems like many progressives want to start history when ex-President Bush took power, and I think that's absolutely false. I think it's a joint swindle by both parties, leaders of both parties, the economists of both parties. And I don't see much relief in sight. I think it's time
for us to start thinking of an alternative approach, not only alternative economic recovery programs, but the political instruments that are compatible with the new program and a new stimulus patent that rebuilds America, that stands up for American industry, publicly owned enterprises. I think there's a certain dogmatism that runs through a lot of the writing, as if the only thing we can think about is in terms of patching up a system. But let's put it this way. An economic system needs banks that can finance and mediate between production and consumers. It needs a industrial sector that gives jobs and produces consumer goods that are necessary for the population. It needs a service sector that maintains an educated and healthy labor force. And what's passing today, this capitalist system, is doing none of the basic ingredients of what an economic system is supposed to do. The banks are not lending. The banks have pilfered the investments and bonds of their holders. The factory system has produced goods people don't want. They can't sell abroad. They're not employing workers. And the service system doesn't serve the people in the health needs. We have 100 million Americans that have inadequate or no health systems. We have an educational system that is out of reach for a good 60% of the population. So when we say that the capitalist system is not a functioning system, we're not talking about ideology. We're just relating it to the realities of today. And when we talk about the need for democratic socialism, it's not based on derived from abstract doctrine. It's based on constructing an economic system which performs the elementary functions that make a civilization function.
There's no question about it, Jim. I was raised in the system, my goodness. Way back next February will be my 50th anniversary of getting out of the Wharton School. And I was young. I was naive. I bought the system. Over time, slowly, I began to see that things in the real world weren't quite exactly the way they taught them to me back at school. And looking back over the last three decades, especially, Jim, since the years of Ronald Reagan, if Chicago school economics was ever shown to be an absolute fraud, a con on the American public, it's all exploded in the last year or so with the colossal problem that we have now. There's no easy way. If they have the best policies in the world, Jim, there is no simple, easy, short-term way out of this mess. The problem is so immense, and economists who've come on this program, Jim, highlight so many things, but one of the things that just has to be cleaned up, even before we start building the society you talk about, is to get rid of this incredible debt problem that we have. We are literally drowning in debt. The country is going bankrupt, and we keep printing more money. Instead of trying to get out from under this debt problem, we keep creating more debt and making the problem greater. And there's a new article on Global Research this morning by Michael Hudson. He put out two in a row, and he just talks about the debt overhang. And we have got to find a way to solve this problem, to reduce this debt, or they can come out with all the crazy policies they want. They're not going to work, and they're going to make things worse, and we'll end up with an even greater terrible situation than we have now, and we're doing all the wrong things.
But I think the recognition in the public is deepening and extending. I think people are much more aware as they experience in their everyday life that this capitalist system is not working for them. It's destroying their life. One out of nine houses are vacant in the United States today. That was an article I read in the Los Angeles Times last week when I was in California. One out of nine, and the underemployment
is reaching 17%, so that means one out of every six, perhaps, Americans today are unable to support themselves through a full-time job. I think that these kinds of everyday experiences, pensioners have lost 40 to 60% of their pensions, and they're living a much worse retirement. More people are not retiring at a retirable age. They're working as bell ringers and taxi drivers in New York or in some of the big cities. So I think that the only silver lining in this is a series of very profound shocks in the conventional everyday thinking of people, and a recognition that capitalism isn't working. Even the jocular headline in Newsweek, "We're all socialists now," talking about the supposed government intervention in the economy, which has nothing to do with socialism, but it indicates that the private capitalist system is not working on writ large. And what we don't need is the kind of state and government intervention which tries to resurrect the corpse of capitalism. What we really need is a clean slate in which Social Security funds are saved for Social Security retirement, where subsidies to big pharma and the extraordinarily wealthy privatized medical system goes into promoting universal health care, where credit is not lent to banks that don't lend to small and medium-sized businesses, but goes directly from government-owned banks into productive activity, etc. So I think there's a very big opening here, eye-opening for millions of Americans. It's no longer simply a corner of American opinion which says that capitalism is bad. I think there's a profound awakening among American people today that the current system doesn't work. The current political leaders, whatever hopes they may have had or continue to have about Obama, are being shattered. And I think we're on the verge within maybe not months, maybe in the next couple of years, of seeing a political earthquake in this country.
Well, we need an earthquake, Jim. I am a nonviolent person, and I certainly don't want to see people rioting, getting hurt in the streets. But we need an earthquake to awaken the politicians and make them realize that you better do something for people, because the level of pain is getting so great. You mentioned a statistic that listeners may have missed the importance of what you said. You talked about 100 million people in the country, either without health care or not enough of it. And I can remember, in a couple of early articles I wrote two or three years ago, talking about 80 million people, 45, 46, 47 million, with no health insurance whatsoever, and maybe another 40 million, at some time during the year, either having much too little or being uninsured. And I read just recently, Jim, that there are projections looking out a year, two, 3 years, that millions more people, because of job losses and so on, will lose their health coverage. So that 100 million figure is very accurate. That really is a devastating figure. What do people do if they get sick and they can't get the health care they need?
I think one of the big issues here is the bankruptcy is largely a result. Personal bankruptcies are largely a result of people that have to mortgage or second mortgage their houses to pay for survival, for physical for physical treatment. And I don't think a lot of people realize how these billings, medical billings, actually bankrupt millions of people in this country.
It's the single biggest cause of personal bankruptcy. these enormous. You have one serious illness, and if you're not covered, try going to a hospital and getting a major surgery and hospital stay that could cost $20,000, $30,000, $40,000. There's no way you're going to get that.
The other thing is, since the union contracts have been totally debilitated, most people are not in unions today, employers have increased the payments of workers into the health plan, so it runs into several hundred dollars a month, and making it optional. So many younger workers, I mean workers under 40, are today not taking out medical plans, betting that they're going to stay healthy, and then they get in a car accident or something similar happens to their family, and they're out. And I think the increasing share that workers and pensioners are paying into their medical plans first reduces their actual income, the bottom line in their pay, and secondly, if it doesn't do that, it makes them extraordinarily vulnerable to serious illnesses and huge medical bills because of the limited liabilities.
Jim, back just around the time I was finishing up grad school before I went to work, I needed to get a health insurance policy to tide me over, and that was at a time. Well, I got health insurance from the companies I worked for the number of years before I got into my family business. But I bought a 1 year plan around late 1959, early 1960. It cost me $100 and change for a full year, and it covered me for anything I was concerned about, certainly anything catastrophic where I might have a serious illness, a long hospital stay, $100 and change. It might have been $110. That wouldn't buy you a week's insurance today.
That's right. It probably needs to double that and maybe triple it to cover a week. I know private businessmen that are paying $1,200 a month to get something resembling an adequate medical coverage today. My barber, for example, is paying $1,200 a month to get him and his wife covered.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the picture here is, I think, of deepening crisis, growing popular awareness in an inadequate and dysfunctional political system. And so I think the political and social engineering in this country is really at the cutting edge of discussion, that people today are looking beyond the elected officials for some political leadership, some social leadership. And I think the quicker that progressive opinion moves away from the slavish faith in Congress and the president, the quicker we'll come to opening up a grand forum in the United States about really dealing with the enormous social problems and the enormous large sections of the public that is being third worldized. I think this reminds me a lot of my experiences in Latin America and Southern Europe years past, where you had massive social programs leading to large-scale social movements that demanded fundamental changes.
As countries like Venezuela rise, Jim, we hold ourselves up as a model for the rest of the world. We are sinking, and in recent years we've been sinking at an accelerated rate, and it really is tragic because you and I are old enough to remember it never was close to the kind of world that we wanted. Looking back, but it was so different way back, and we've seen ourselves just descend slowly, progressively, and maybe since the age of Ronald Reagan and then Clinton and certainly George Bush, we have really just accelerated our decline, and we really are becoming a banana republic. And I feel for young people today, Jim. I just don't know what they have to look forward to.
I feel also for pensioners who worked all their life and have lost their pension. I mean, the generation in their 60s, many of whom are not at work now, they're listening to this program. And I'm sure if they checked into their pension funds, they just have to look at their monthly statements. I'm sure they're extremely nervous and anxious and stressed by the lowering amounts that are turning over in to cover their rent and food or their mortgage, or if they have their house paid off, meeting their essentials. And I think one thing we ought to remember is that the basic changes that took place in the United States, the end of the Vietnam War, the beginning of civil rights legislation, and back into the 30s, the New Deal, were all products of mass movements, sit-ins in the auto plants, massive black uprisings in the ghettos, massive street protests to end the war. I think we have some recent historical examples.
Oh, indeed, Jim. We have to break again. Welcome back. Jim, we just have a few minutes left. There's no question that all the big changes that have been won by people since this country became a country have always begun at the grassroots, from ending slavery, civil rights, the right of women to vote. It's hard for people to remember that when the founders created the country, only the better off white people could vote. About 15% of the population. So we revere those people. They were far from perfect, to say the least. And only 15% of people could vote. But it's the grassroots movements that will have to change the country. The politicians won't do it. We have to kick them in the butt and make them do it.
That's true, Steve. I agree with that. And many times kicking them in the butt is not enough. It's kick them out of office.
Kick them out of office.
Not people from the same party, but create new parties with new leaders that are more responsive to, more representative of the people they purport to represent, not the people that finance their campaigns.
Well, in the 1850s, Jim, we got a brand new party in this country. Listeners don't remember the Whigs. Neither do I, except I know they existed. But we got a brand new party. Unfortunately, it kind of went astray. It was called the Republicans. And a few years later, 1860, a guy named Abe Lincoln became president. Well, he wasn't the saint, but compared to what we have now, I'll take him.
Yes, I think we need a great revival. I don't mean under a big tent with any televangelists, but I think we need a party that embraces the working people, public employees, young professionals, blacks, Hispanics, white workers, working mothers, consumers, ecologists. I mean, there's a huge, huge constituency out there, each with their own demands. But I think it can only be successful if we unify these particular identities and sets of interests into one coherent program that's taking back America, reindustrializing the country, and eliminating all of the financial shenanigans that pass off as financial instruments, and stop wasting our money on speculation and putting it to work,
Jim,
in a productive way for public services and producing useful goods.
Jim, we're just about out of time. There was one other topic I wanted to bring up today, and we didn't have any time. Maybe I can get you back in a few weeks, and we can do it. And that's to talk about what's going on in Israel right now. They had an election on the 10th of the month. They're shifting to the right. I've got a brand new article that I'm just finishing up. I'll probably get it out before this week is over, on the elections and showing we know Israel is militaristic, but they're really shifting more to the right. It's pretty dangerous. You wrote about Obama, our first Jewish president. you got to come back so we can talk about that.
Okay, Steve, I look forward to it. It's certainly a very dangerous and ominous development, and unfortunately, most of the major pro-Israel groups in this country haven't recognized that. They just keep following whatever policies come out of Israel and out of the temples and pulpits and other places that keep preaching the war. So I think it's a very, very relevant topic, Steve, and I look forward to reading your articles.
And I'll shoot you an email with some days, Jim. They're about to break away, so all I have time for is to thank you again for coming on. We'll do it again soon, and this is the kind of programming people need.
Okay. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Jim. We'll be back with another live program tomorrow. Please join us.